All right, well, we're back and looking at this again, and I'm thinking about all that needs to be covered or said, and Lord, just take this whichever direction it should be going is my prayer, because there's way too much to cover than what we can talk about in this short time. I would like to just talk a little bit about the process of spanking, because it's such an important part in the toddler's age life and in the scholar's stage for two totally different reasons, but it's in a very important part in clearing the air and maintaining a relationship of reconciliation with the child. You have a baseline, and I'm on page 11 down there at scholar stage, but you have a baseline of love and acceptance. And as you know that child, you know they have strengths and you know they have weaknesses, and you have a heart of compassion. You remember that they are flesh, okay? You remember that they get a lot off, chip off the old block from your personality. And as you look at that, you look at them with pity, but you realize that there are guidelines, there are norms for acceptable behavior, and there are lines that they are not allowed to cross. And as you have those reasonable boundaries, there comes a time when it's in a child, they just will. I remember that. I remember determining I was never going to be bad again. I was never going to get another spanking again. And then you'd find yourself doing it. And I heard some of your stories the other night. I know that we're all made out of the same stuff, and it just it happens. And so a child has crossed the line, and you know that you're going to have to deal with him. In your working with a child, don't let them pitch a fit. You come to a place where you condition them to know what to expect with a punishment. It doesn't start that way all at first. But I think it's good to have a place. And the place we use for, when I was a boy, it was in my father's study. I knew exactly where we were going. And if we were headed there, I knew what was going to happen next. He would not allow us to jump around. We were expected to stand still. And if you didn't, if you jumped around, you'd first get a spanking for jumping around. And then after you settled down, then he'd go back to the original cause. But trying to intimidate him was not going to work, because he was going to bring us into line. And with our children, I'd take them into our bedroom and have them lay over the bed. That's what was expected for them to get a spanking. And, you know, if it's a small child and you can't be at your bed, don't wail away on their diaper. If it's not going to hurt, you may as well save your time. But you might need to pull up the dress and get there on the side of the thigh. Somebody has said that God designed the human anatomy, and he made a connection between the backside and the brain. And it's right connected to the behavior sector of the brain. And if you get a spanking there, you will learn, because it does. It has a way of making that connection. With the right kind of an instrument, I like to try three good swats. And if the child can look at you and they're crying, they're accepting it. I'm talking about a toddler now, and it's gotten through, that's enough. But if they look at you and they're still at defiance, at rebellion, you know, and or they won't look at you, then you know that you're just getting started, and you try it again, and they give them a chance. And once they surrender, they write it on their face, and it comes out of their eyes, and then it's over. And the thing to then is just take them up in your arms. And you know, it's so fascinating. If you really got through with a discipline, you'll be off. Maybe you'll be reading or writing. I'll be in the study, or something will be happen. And a little fellow will come up beside you, and he just wants to be cuddled again. Now, no chastening for the present seems to be joyous, but grievous. Nevertheless, afterward, it yieldeth the peaceable fruit of righteousness. The reconciliation is complete. The child wants your heart, your affirmation again. And as you put your arm around them and you tell them that you love them, and you're going to go together from there, it just makes a bond. That it's just great. It's a wonderful, wonderful opportunity. Now, the reason why you work with a preschooler is to train them to hearken. But as they come to the age here now, whenever they are scholars, you have a different point. I don't know when a person starts to hear from his conscience. I asked some of my grandchildren one time, when did a voice start talking to you that you should do something or you shouldn't do something? or when you had done bad, that you had done wrong and you should go make it right. When did you start to hear that? And my grandchildren actually thought that it started somewhere when they were 4. But I don't know when that is. But I know that somewhere it's your, as parents, a goal to teach a child not just to hearken now, but to listen on that voice inside that tells him when to do something, what not to do. But that's the beginning of internal controls, because that internal controls are then what will guide him as he develops a sound conscience. Speak, Lord, for thy servant heareth. I want to hear. I want to listen. I want God to talk to me. And as you work with a child, you can see that begin to develop with them. So as we talk about this scholar stage, and you talk with them, you do exactly what the proverb writer did. He talks about spanking a child and making them hearken, but then there comes a time whenever he talks to the child. And you have that in Proverbs 4, Proverbs 6, chapter 6, 7, you go all the way to chapter 23, and all the way back to chapter 30, and 31. I don't know. Let's just look at 31 right now. I so often go to these verses myself. I'd just like to show you again, and this is a mother talking, and it's so valuable to see what an older generation sees fit to tell the child, the son. And maybe this is a youth, because he's older, of course, than a preschooler. But I don't know where it is, but she says this, the words of King Lemuel, the prophecy that his mother taught him. What, my son? And what, the son of my womb? And what, the son of my vows? Give not your strength to women, unto women, nor thy ways to that which destroyeth kings. It is not for kings, O Lemuel, it is not for kings to drink wine, nor for princes strong drink, lest they drink and forget the law and pervert the judgment of any of the afflicted. Give strong drink unto him that is ready to perish, and wine unto those that be of heavy hearts. Let him drink and forget his poverty, and remember his misery no more. Open thy mouth for the dumb, in the cause of all such as are appointed to destruction. Open thy mouth, judge righteously, and plead the cause of the poor and the needy. And so there's three distinct subjects addressed here. There's that whole attraction for the opposite sex. And mom is talking to her son, and she's saying, you know what? You're going to find out that you're attracted to girls, or you might be attracted to pictures. And son, there's something you'll have to learn to say no to. Be very careful, and don't give in. Don't give in to this thing, because it can become a master in your life. And I know that fathers primarily should speak to their sons about the facts of life. But moms, you can say something too, to help to steer them in the right direction. It's not a taboo subject for you. It's something that you can talk about. And then the next thing she says is, don't take mood-altering substances. That's in my words. It was wine back then. But I asked the men at Shepherd's Fold one day, what's the difference between the meds that they gave you as a child and the meds, the street drugs that you got when you were older? They said, there's no difference. All of them just change the way you feel about yourself. And this woman says, you know what? Sometime you're going to have the opportunity to get involved in things that change your feelings about yourself. Don't go there, because it will change your ability to judge. I don't know what happens. I don't understand really if it's your body where your judgment comes from. I think it's your soul. But there's a disconnect there, and your soul is unable to relate to the pain of other people, and so you're not able to judge right. She does say, give strong drink to them that's ready to perish. You know, if your preacher would say, I really think that old folks ought to go get drunk, y'all would probably run him out of here. But we're very careful about that. I believe there is a place perhaps for people who are really in extreme suffering, and their judgment is taken, but certainly not for growing children, and certainly not for adults who are in the prime of life and the responsibilities of life, you need to taste life to its full color, and you need to be able to experience what God has for you. And then she says, be sensitive to people who are oppressed. Be really, really sensitive. Care about other people. Don't just think about yourself. But care about other people and what they're going through. Because as you care about the hurting, it will do something for you. Open your mouth and judge righteously and plead for the cause of the poor and needy. Now, how did I get from there to here? Somewhere, this boy remembered this conversation. And did it happen whenever he was a scholar or a youth or soon after he got married? I don't know. But somewhere he remembered that kind of teaching coming through from mom. And there's so many things that we look back and remember for those who took the time to talk to us. And I just feel like that's such an important part now as we come and as the conscience is developed. It's intriguing to me that if you go to Joshua 1 and he starts and you read about how God came to Joshua and he said, be strong and of a good courage. And if you read back in Deuteronomy and Moses is talking to Joshua, he's using a lot of the same phrases, almost sounds like the same verses. And so what Joshua said to what Moses said to Joshua, when God talked to Joshua later, it sounded like he got it direct. It sounded like the voice of his mentor who was talking to him again. And that's so true about life. When people take time to give you counsel and talk to your heart, and I'm not talking about in this stage, if you try to talk a toddler into listening to you, you got to make sure you have that paddle along with him. But when you get to this stage in life, there's a lot of talking that needs to come. But what happens then when all of a sudden you're at the table and you realize he won't look at you anymore? Something is wrong. Or you're out in the garden. I remember one of those scenes. And interestingly enough, I'm the only one who remembers it of the children. But I remember a time when I realized that my son was trying to keep a distance from me. And so finally I asked him, I said, hey, what's going on? There's something wrong. The Bible says if we walk in the light, we have fellowship one with another, and I sense that there's something in between us. You won't look at me, and there's something going on. And then he admitted that down in the woods that he and some of the other children were getting into some things that they shouldn't have done, some of the curiosity. Now, I want to just say something about that. When children get involved in their explorations and in their curiosity into things that are not right, off color, of a sexual nature, don't overreact. Don't overreact, because they're curious, it's normal. But you need, and I'm not saying, we learned things after our children were grown up that I was really humiliated about, but that was one time whenever I was so thankful, because by being sensitive and realizing that there was a barrier coming between us, I realized that there was a boy starting to develop, going down a road that he shouldn't be going down. And as we talked it out, and there was some punishment given there, and talked to the other individual that was involved, neither one of them remembers it to this day. I don't believe that it has scarred them. I believe that it was one of those things that, because it was taken care of, it's part of. I've had lots of bumps and bruises and cuts and scrapes, and they've all healed up, and they don't affect me anymore, except I can look at it and say, whoa, I don't want to do that again. That's just the way it is in life. And I just believe at this stage in life that whenever a child does something and their conscience is bothering them, the best thing you can do, even a scholar, it's not very often anymore, but second, third, fourth, fifth graders, they do something they know they shouldn't. The best way to clear the air is to give them a good spanking. Again, a paddle. Three licks, it clears the air, there's a good hug, they know it's over and you'll never bring it up again. Now, does that mean they'll ever fall again? If they fall again, you can do it again. It's okay. But eventually, it soaks through and it learns. But the time of spankings really diminishes. I really think that children shouldn't feel like they're off limits for spankings until they come to the point where they give their hearts to the Lord. Really. Somewhere in there, the accountability shifts to God, and they begin to give answer to him for what they do. On page 13, I'd like to talk about adolescence now. And my son, give me thine heart. I love that verse in Proverbs 23. Because as children are at this age and they're developing a lot of friends, you still want their heart as you walk together. And adolescence is when spiritual, social, and sexual interests awaken. And so you lead your child to a conversion experience, and you begin to transfer the accountability from yourself to Christ in the brotherhood. And there's times then to talk to the child to help him evaluate his friendships. Which friends does he have? And what needs to change in his life so that he's naturally attracted to people of better character? Those are the kind of discussions that you can have with him as you relate to him. Adolescence on the chart here, looking at that, the time to develop values, to be held accountable, to receive external disciplines. When internal discipline is not yet developed, you become a mentor, parole officer. You have confidential talks about developing temptations and habits, and to talk about sin and guilt. Accountability and consequences is your duty. Give appropriate information, warnings, and proper consequences for moral development. And they are expected to show discipline in sleeping, eating, work, and purity habits to maintain healthy friendships and to choose to become a Christian. That's the kind of thing that you expect in that stage of life, in that season, as you work with them. And I would say, you know, there comes a time whenever the spankings are over and your opportunities are closed. But then you talk about what you see. Proverbs chapter 7, father is one day, he is looking out the window. For at the window of my house, I looked through my casement, and I beheld among the simple ones, I discerned among the youths, a young man void of understanding, passing through the street near her corner. And he went the way to her house in the twilight, in the evening, in the black and dark night. And behold, there met him a woman with the attire of an harlot and subtle of heart. What happens? What's happening here? A father is seeing something, and he says, you know what? I need to go tell my son about that, because that's happening. Sooner or later, children will learn about the facts of life. And sooner or later, they will find out about the kind of sins that become vices in people's lives and becomes a warning to them. And I'm just flip over now because, let's see, it seemed like I had a little bit of something written about that. It's so important to let your child know that you can talk about his struggle. Maybe on page 15, it's a parent's responsibility, it's letter C, 5C, to inform the child of his development, warn him of temptations that he will face, and instruct him how to respond when he finds himself tempted. Instruction creates bonding. I remember a young man one time after we were married, and he was married. We're driving along, and he asked me the question. He said, Steve, what's self-abuse? And I was shocked. I didn't think anybody grew up without knowing about those moral temptations. And so I asked him, you know, how did you grow up and you don't know what that is? And so he told me about his father. He told me how that he remembers as being a young child. His father was injured then and couldn't relate to him in the same way. But as a young child, his father taught him what parts of the body were appropriate for other people to see and touch and which ones weren't and how he should relate to that. His father taught him that there's places that people can touch you, like when you're playing tag on your hands or whenever you embrace, you can around the shoulder. But other than that, there's places where your hands don't go and where you don't allow other people. And these are conversations that moms need to have at an age probably before anybody else has talked to them, if somebody or done those things to them. And sometimes you'll find out you got there too late. Unfortunately, that does happen sometimes. But whoever is willing to talk to the child about these very, very personal subjects forms a bond with them. And if you don't do that, somebody else will be all too happy to give them the information that they want to find out. Where did you find out? Your own frame of reference is a really good place to start. When did you get into a bad habit? What happened to you? Where did it start? And then you go and talk to your child about that. it gives them some understanding that this is a subject you can talk about and you can relate to. So when he has temptations, and you see these things here that we have written down here with personal development, exposure to predators, people will find them, your own habits of what to be involved in, this snare of pornography, and then of carnal courtship, and the counsel that a child needs to receive in his own development. Because if a child does not get that, and he falls into this vice, and it becomes an addiction in his life, it can become a defining, something that stunts his freedom in Christ, and something that stunts his own personal development. And you've had some responsibility in that. On the other hand, if you found that you got involved in those things, we know that there is freedom in Christ and there's deliverance from that if a person is willing to face that. But it's so important that in this stage of life, you taught them to listen, but at this stage now you talk to them about what they need to know and how they need to see life from a perspective where they're not already caught up in that. Now, going back to the youth, when emotional, vocational, and life companion interest awaken, get your child to share what his dreams are in life. What do you want to be? What would you like to do? What do you have an interest in? I remember yet when my father found out that I had an interest in drawing. He said, well, let's go talk to a draftsman, because he felt like that would be a good thing to do. And you know, the longer I listened, the more I realized I didn't want to do that for life. I didn't. And so I told him that. But it was something that I knew that he cared about my personal interest and was ready to lend his resources for that. And so I felt like he was on my side. Now, you may need to give guidance when you feel that your son's dreams are not realistic for his nature or for your resources. We had a son who really wanted to be a doctor. And we steered him away from that. I wasn't quite sure that his personality, I'm not saying that was wrong for everyone. We have a daughter who's a nurse, and I think that's what stirred him somewhat, but we steered him away from that. And I don't think it's wrong for parents to steer your child, but as they come to youth, you become a resource for them. Help them, well, to get a driver's license. Open the savings and then a checking account and getting a job and developing their skills for life. You don't just need exercise. As you face life, you need to learn how to be able to do something well so you can serve in that category, that area in life. And so as you encourage your child in what his interests are in his spiritual and emotional journey, you'll find that he will open up. And I want to talk about that a little bit, because after developing a conscience, is in this stage of development, somewhere there when a child starts understanding his emotions. And not every child will have emotional struggles, but it's not unusual for teenagers to have them. It's not unusual for teenagers to feel insecure, to struggle with their thoughts, to even think about doing away with themselves. It's not unusual. And whenever they want to talk about that, it would be wrong for you to react and say, oh, what's wrong with you? Why do you even think about it? Let's talk about it. Tell me what you're struggling with is the way a parent should respond. I believe the way a parent should respond with that. I remember a child that I thought was hopelessly insecure. And they had this question about the unpardonable sin and the struggles with assurance. And it was also a time when we were going through a lot of stress in church life. And I was very, very busy. And it was such a temptation for me to just push him away. You're taking up too much of my time. But in praying about it one day, I felt led to say, is this really about the unpardonable sin? Or is this really about that you would like to have a deeper relationship with me? And he was like, well, I really do struggle, Father. I feel like you're all wrapped up in your world and you don't care about me. And I realized then, I got an insight that what I needed to do was bring the subject up to him. I realized I was sending signals that I don't care about what's happening on you, with you on the inside. It's what's happening. My world is more important. But when I went to him and I said, hey, how's this struggle going? Are you battling this thing? I only had to bring it up about 3 times. And it was gone. I couldn't believe how it was over after that. It went away so fast. As long as I was shoving him away and running away from it, it kept growing. But when I went after him and said, how's this journey with assurance and you feeling like God doesn't love you? It went away. I just found that so interesting. Later on, he had a really deep struggle again. And well, I don't know if you ever get over it. Biggest struggle I ever went with my own emotions whenever I was probably 45, I think. And this whole journey with fear, and I thought I was losing my mind. But it was such a time whenever I found God in a new way, a real way, and I found out that it's true that there's no fear in love. Perfect love casteth out fear. We had a couple of airplane experiences, and I became afraid to travel in the airplane. Whenever I bought tickets, I'd just feel these surges of fear go through me. And after a while, I became afraid of my fear. I became afraid to drive. I thought I was going to kill myself. And I was, I'm ashamed to tell you this, but I was serving as bishop and had responsibilities and just being afraid of my own self. And as I prayed about this and a couple of things that happened that showed me that it's because my focus was on myself. And I had to go to my family and confess that I've been wrapped up in my own world and it's time for me to start caring about you and finding that what you're doing is important. And as I threw my life into them, I found out that if I wasn't the center of the world, that my emotional equilibrium was restored. It's so simple and yet it's so complicated, so hard to find. Now, I would like to just continue on here in page 14, and I'll try to cut this short now. There's a few more things that I want to say. Maintain an atmosphere of leadership and involvement in your child's life. Refuse to be intimidated. A rule of thumb is when internal controls are not working, external controls must be put in place for character and conviction to develop. The temptation is when youth fret about the control you give them, the standard you wish to hold them to begin to back off, hoping that they will see it on their own. But growing up on the outside and growing up on the inside are two different things. Outward ability does not guarantee license and liberty. And when youth do not behave appropriately, dress themselves consistently, make spiritual choices with their resources, it's not only the youth who are to blame, but also their parents. And I'm pretty much set that 14, 15, 16, and 17, it's just plenty young to be let youth run. And I ran into this with our older children. It was a norm for people to run with the youth when they turned 16, and I can't fix the system. I'll let that alone. But I told our boys that whenever there is a gathering and there are girls and it's a youth group thing and you're alone, I'm not going to let you go to those, not until you're 18. And they began to, they were resentful of that. And this came to a head one time where, as my memory recalls it, we finally sat down and had a talk. I said, the rule for our family is a mixed setting. It's just youth. You're not going to go till you're 18 because I don't think you have the internal controls that behave the way that you should. And after I laid that down and they got resentful, we had another discussion about it. And I said, look, you're at a stage of life. They were 16. One of them was 16. You're in a stage of life where either we can make it nice for each other because I have the resources, I have a little money, I have driver's license, I have vehicles, and you don't. If you work with me and I have your cooperation, then I will give you my resources and I will help you to grow into whatever God calls you to. But if not, I'm not going to back down. I have too many children coming on to back down and start giving up and letting you have your own way. So they called me into the bedroom later, and especially the two boys, and they told me this. They said, Father, we've decided that we're going to cooperate with you. We're going to work with you. We're not going to fight you, and we want you to help us, and we'll help you. We'll work together. But we want you to know, when we get big like you are, we're not going to have stupid rules for our youth like you have. I am still waiting to see. Oh, I've probably got ahead of myself. Do not permit a generation gap. I liked what was drawn here. You know, I grew up in a situation where the parents were walking one way, but this whole thing of not making your children listen and letting them develop who they're really going to be, and the children start going this way. And so fathers and mothers believed in the separation from the world in dress and separation in behavior. And children did it, and they were going this way. And the gap got huge. And then I saw that instead of having that gap, they turn around and start chasing their youth. Today, the preachers and teachers that I admired whenever I was young, they're dying. You see them in the obituaries. And I visited the bishop who baptized me some time ago in the old people's home. And his mind was gone, but his wife was pretty clear yet. And I feel so sorry for them. Because the values that they thought they would have, they don't have anymore. It's gone. I feel so bad about that. And they didn't have to do that. They didn't have to let their children go and practice something different than themselves. Now, I realize that tradition can get too big. Tradition can get to the place where it's even more than the Bible. But I just want to say this. There's nothing wrong and son needing to apply the Bible the way dad did it. There's nothing wrong in that. Don't be too much against tradition. I'll just give you that counsel. Because it is something that helps to hold generations together. When worldliness and rebellion become the norm for our youth, the course of the church will be affected. Because youth crave acceptance. They want to fit in, but they also crave attention and they want to be different. And so the youth group develops its own personality apart from the heartthrob and spirituality of the parents. You've got problems. The days are numbered. The church is soon going to be over. If they look more to their peer group for their acceptance and attention than to their parents, they will not find the right guidance and directions. And today, we especially face outside challenges. We don't just have reading material and dress issues, but we have technology issues. Cell phone, smartphones, all the entertainment world. Where are you going to be with that? If you have this established that they will listen, and you have here that they will hearken to your counsel, then you can give direction in those things too and work together. But if you don't, our days are numbered. Not just you. It's every church group that faces this. We're going to have to be together or we won't make it at all. Well, courtship. I'd like to go to the last page there, page 16. And the rule of thumb for courtship is that it's intended to extend the family borders and not isolate members from their family ties. And youth need to be warned about clandestine emotional involvements, hidden things. You know, he that entereth in by the door is a shepherd of the sheep. But he that climbeth up some other way is a thief and a robber. I know that not everybody that's interested in your daughter or whatever is bad. But if it has to be kept secret, there's something wrong. The way my house is, if you drive into our house, drive down the driveway, you can see the front door and then the side. And if you keep going to the shop out back, you can see the back door. Now, suppose I came down the driveway one day and there's somebody trying to get in the front door, a young man at the front door knocking. And as I drove past the house and I looked and there's somebody in there trying to break in the back window, the back bedroom window. They have a stick in their hand and they're breaking the window and they're trying to get in. There's a couple of things that I would know. Number one is that they both want to get into the house. They want something inside. But I would know something different about the character of both of those. Immediately, the one who comes to the front door, I would know that he is honorable and he's ready to be above board and face things. But the one who sneaks around the back and tries to break in the back window, I would know that he is of questionable character. Now, I'm not talking about breaking into a house at all. I'm talking about trying to find a young woman for your life. There's an honorable way to do that, and there's a dishonorable way. And dads, let's don't let it down. Let's don't let them down. Let's require them to come. Talk to us. That's a change that's been made in my lifetime. I didn't go ask my father-in-law if I could date his daughter. We did to get married, but I didn't know you should have done that. But I should have done that. I should have talked to him first. And that is an honorable way, and it works well. And so parents should have the say whether a child is mature enough or not. And courtship should be for the purpose of marriage, not just fun. But then eventually the time comes when father has to say yes. And I believe that this step is so important. Will you finally come to a place of trust? Will you say, I know you're making some mistakes, I can see them, but you know what? I believe your heart is right, and I'm going to trust you and let you go. Have I had any perfect young men that were perfect enough that I had no misgivings about them dating my daughters? I don't think it's possible for them to be perfect enough. There was something in me that wanted to keep every one of my daughters at our house, you know, even the ones who had left already. Why, I had invested so much into them, and he's just a young whippersnapper. He doesn't know much at all. And here he comes along and he thinks he can walk off with her for life. But guess what? When you trust him and let him go, it's God's plan. But it hurts so bad because, you know, when a son gets married, he becomes more like you. All of a sudden he's raising children, and you can talk about that and all the other things. When a daughter gets married, you were the man in her life and you're not anymore. I mean, in so many ways, he becomes the man. But it's a good thing. It's God's plan. And when you put your blessing on that, and I shouldn't have to do this, but I know occasions where men refuse to let their daughters go, where men refuse to trust the next generation. And all you do is end up hurting yourself. When God calls them to that stage in life, trust his calling and trust his enablement and put your blessing on there and say, if we can be of any resource, we're here. We're here to talk. We want to undergird you and help you to go forward. True yoke fellows, it's such a blessing to come to a stage in life where you not only serve together at family time, but in church life, boards and committees. You know, you just can't put a price tag on it. It's such a blessing. And you look back and you say, all the things that you did wrong, and yet there was still somebody who made it happen. Except the Lord build the house, they labor in vain that build it. But when God builds it, he is able to see you through. And God bless you in your family life. I'm sure there's some things that I said from my setting that may be a little different. Mind the Lord, follow him, and let him guide you in life. God bless you.